Navigating Difficult Issues, Department of Marine Resources Commissioner Pat Kelleher. It has never been an easy job to head DMR. It's never been easy to balance the competing interests over Maine's precious marine resource. But right now is an especially difficult time. As conservationists try to protect the critically endangered right whale, many in the lobstering community believe they are being unfairly targeted, and they are worried about their future. There are also conflicts between seaweed harvesters, landowners, and fishing communities, controversies over land-based aquaculture projects planned for Maine communities, an elver fishery exploding in value, and the ever-present reality of warming waters in the Gulf of Maine. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will talk about those issues and more with the man who has been commissioner of the Department of Marine Resources since 2011. Pat Kelleher on Maine Calling next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Some of the most pressing issues in Maine right now have to do with our state's marine resources. We're going to talk about those today with our guest, who is here with me in our Augusta studio. Pat Kelleher is commissioner of Maine's Department of Marine Resources. He has been in this role since 2011 and was reappointed by Governor Mills in 2019. As always, we want to hear from you in the audience. What do you want to know about the lobster industry or whale protection or aquaculture? Email talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Pat Kelleher, welcome back to Maine Calling.
Yeah, thank you.
So let's start with the item that's really in the news today. Last night, as we just heard in Fred's story, you met with lobstermen. And I want to step back a little bit. You are trying to come up with a plan that the federal government, NOAA, will accept that finds a balance between protecting the critically endangered right whales and Maine's lobster industry. Do you believe that you found something that the federal government will accept?
The $64 million question. I'm not sure whether they're going to accept it or not. They can't predetermine the outcome. They're looking at our proposal right now. Our proposal is very diverse. We have many more tools to our available to us from an enforcement standpoint and a policy standpoint. What I do know is that if the National Marine Fisheries Service was going to put rules into effect without any kind of input from the Maine lobster fishery, the tools that they have are very blunt. And they would be two things: very large closed areas during times of the year where harvest is going to be some at its either at its highest from a volume standpoint or from the value standpoint, when it may not have a high volume landing, but it might be when the price might be $8 to $10 a pound. So there could be very severe economic impacts. And trap reductions is the other tool. So what we've done is try to look at the data to make determinations where right whales are liable to be within the Gulf of Maine and within the footprint of the Maine lobster fishery, and try to tailor our focus based on what the data is telling us.
So different rules for those traveling pathways where the right whales are most likely to be than, for example, closer to shore.
Correct.
Where they're not likely to be.
Yeah, what we know now, based on the changing environment that we have within the Gulf of Maine, Callinus, which is their main food source, is not as available here as it is, say, in Mass Bay or up in the Gulf of St. Lawrence. So what we know is we don't have feeding aggregations. We have transient whales that are moving between these areas. So knowing that we have sighting data that shows that they're farther offshore, that's where the bulk of our protections are going to go.
All right. And you're looking at things like, instead of closing hole areas, having sort of release. Explain what would happen.
The two main pieces of the state's proposals include weak rope, where we would make the rope weaker in the top half of the line. So if a whale does come in contact, it has the ability to break off and not entangle that whale. But the other thing we've done is our proposal removes 25% of the end lines out of the Gulf of Maine.
What does that mean?
An end line is the line from the buoy to the trap. So if you have a 10-trap trawl, on each end of that trawl, you would have a buoy. And so by making trawls longer, you're taking lines out of the fishery. And so those two things give us a reduction that we hope will be satisfactory to the powers that be in Washington.
You presented this to a large group of lobstermen last night. What did they say about it? What was your reaction?
Last night's meeting was the Lobster Advisory Council. That council is made up of members from every one of the zones. They're well versed in this, and so they were asking clarifying questions on what that means. But you know, at the end of the day, what I'm trying to do is create a balance, put meaningful protections on the table, but preserving the economic prosperity of the fishery. I think we've done that. It's not perfect. And so a key component of our plan is conservation equivalencies by zone and allowing zones to try to work within the bounds of the plan. If they see something in the plan that they don't like, to make modifications that say if it gives up 5% and from a risk tolerance standpoint in one area, that we can find another way to gain that 5% back and sort of mix and match our approaches.
My understanding, you just submitted this a couple weeks ago.
That's correct.
What is the timeline now? When does Maine find out if this is accepted by the federal government?
I'm hoping that it'll be late spring, early summer. They'll have to go out through a Federal Register notice. There'll be a lot of public hearings on this up and down the coast. So this is, while it feels like, okay, we've completed our plan, there's still a lot of work to be done.
Okay, so between now and then, no change?
No change. In the fishing year 2020, we should see no change unless the courts step in. There are lawsuits that are still outstanding, so the courts could intervene here if they don't believe that the federal government's doing enough. And we're hoping that by having our plan on the table, there is an alternative there if the court did want to intervene in the process.
Pat, correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that this is against a backdrop in which lobster landings are down significantly.
Well, earlier in the year, I reported out, and it was picked up by the press. When I'm sitting in a room in Washington and I say something, I forget that people are still listening on the online. But at the time I reported it out, we were down about 40% in lobster landings. Last year, our landings were around 120 million pounds. We will be down. We'll be down many millions of pounds this year. I would guess we'll be around the 100 million pound mark. But value is up some, so that's a good thing. Now, there are other cost areas that are up. Bait, for instance, is an issue in many areas of the coast. So price of bait is up, and some harvest might be down in other areas. So everybody, area to area, fisherman to fisherman, has probably been impacted a little bit differently.
All right. And when you say bait cost is up, it's because we have almost a crisis, really, in the...
From an Atlantic herring standpoint, we had major reductions in the herring quota. Now, that was offset by the fact that menhaden were here in very big numbers this year. While Maine's quota is only about 2.4 million pounds, I was able to work with other states, have additional quota transferred into the state. So we landed 17 million pounds of menhaden. So that certainly offset the big cuts we saw.
So dodged the bullet.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's talk about some other fisheries. Pat, over the last few years, all of us have learned a great deal about elvers. I don't think most people even knew what they were, these beautiful tiny glass eels. And this is just a fishery for Maine that's exploding. You've proposed some new regulations. Tell me about those.
Well, over the last 8 years, we really got this fishery under control. It was there was a lot of black market eels being sold. There were a lot of problems with this fishery. We now have a quota established. We have limited entry fisheries. We actually have individual quotas. So a fisherman, the quotas range anywhere from the lowest is around 4 pounds. I can't actually talk about what the upper limits are because they're bound by confidentiality based on an individual, but there are many people that have more than 50 pounds, I can say. So there's a lot of money in that fishery. It's valued at $12 to $15 million annually. It's a 10-week fishery valued at that that high level. We still have some issues, though, for exporting. And so what we ran into a few years ago is a big case that Marine Patrol was able to make with some individuals who were going around our no-cash provision and buying eels under the table for cash. So we've closed that loophole by protecting the chain of custody. So if elvers are going to be shipped out of state by an exporter, We have Marine Patrol go in and inspect that and seal that load with a very special seal that is numbered, and then we share that information with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So as those eels leave Maine and they receive, then are received at an airport for shipment and inspection, they can see that the Maine Marine Patrol sealed that load, and then we can show without a doubt that that hasn't been tampered with. And so that's the key component from a chain of custody standpoint.
Do you feel confident, Pat, that the Elver fishery is at a place now where it will not be overfished and we won't be, you know, talking 20 years from now about back when it was so great?
Yeah, I do. I mean, if you had asked me that 10 years ago, I would have said no. But we've made one. We're really the only elver fishery on the East Coast other than Canada. There's a very small one down in the Carolinas, but there's 10 licenses and a very small amount of eels are taken. The yellow eel fishery, in comparison, is much bigger. You're taking breeding stock out.
Elvers, that's fully grown eels that are being harvested in the rest of the East Coast, right?
So that's there are glass eels, which are the juveniles. Yellow eels are eels that range anywhere from 1 up until 15 to 25 years of age. Then they become silver eels, and that's when they migrate out to the Sargasso Sea. That yellow eel harvest really, to me, is where we need to continue to focus our efforts. The Maine glass eel fishery, why it is very valuable and it has ramifications from a management standpoint, and I think we've got it under control. You know, what may still be out of control is not under the control of the Maine Department of Marine Resources, still black market harvest in other states. But those are the issues that the other states need to deal with. We've controlled our fishery in a very good way.
Let me ask you this. I know that the glass eels are shipped primarily to Asia, where they grow to adulthood and then are sold as seafood. Is there any thought, any initiative to grow them to full?
It's happening right here in the state right now.
Yeah, in the state. Yeah.
Yeah, and so I'm going to forget this, and Sarah's going to kill me. But she's just we have a company now that is buying eels, glass eels, from harvesters, growing them out in facilities here in Maine, and not sending them overseas. And we. Overseas growth hormones are used within the grow-out process. She's not using growth hormones. This is just a selection of eels. She separates them as they grow out, so she's able to put faster-growing ones in other tanks and continue to monitor the process and grows them out to a size that becomes marketable. And she's doing that right here in the state.
And are they already coming to market?
They're already going to market.
Wonderful. Yep. We're talking with Department of Marine Resources Commissioner Patrick Kelleher right now. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. On the line with us now is Ben Martins. He's Executive Director of Maine Coast Fishermen's Association. Thanks for calling in, Ben.
Thanks for having me.
So I know there are many issues your association's working on. Is there a top priority or concern you want to talk about?
Yeah, we've got a couple of high priorities for the state, and the biggest for us is making sure that we have a diverse fleet, that it catches a lot of different types of species that come across the docks. But that's the highest and biggest issue that we're working on every day. But we also have been hearing from a lot of fishermen about the concerns around the working waterfront as well. And that's something that's come up in Portland recently and in communities throughout the state.
Okay. And Congresswoman Pingree has a bill before Congress. Are you hopeful that that will pass and have the effect you want?
We would love to see that move forward. We worked closely with the Congresswoman. She met with fishermen in Portland and in other places within district to really kind of flesh that out. And a lot of opportunity there. Hard to get anything to move through Congress right now, though, as you well know.
So I was wondering if you have a question for Commissioner Kelleher.
I do. Thank you so much for the opportunity. And Pat, it's great to hear from you. The working waterfront, as I said, is really important. It's important statewide infrastructure. And we are hearing from fishermen that they don't get enough resources to properly protect and maintain the docks and piers that are so crucial to the seafood industry in our state. So what's the Department of Marine Resources and the administration doing to make sure that fishermen have the access that they need throughout Maine and especially considering the increasing pressure from development and tourism and new uses that our coastal communities are experiencing?
Yeah, thanks for that question, Ben. I think access to the water and working waterfront remained a top priority for the Department of Marine Resources. One of my other hats, I am the chair of the Land for Maine Future Committee, and we spend bond money that has been allocated for land conservation, but a segment of that bond money is also allocated for working waterfront, where we can receive applications and fund up to 25% of the value of a particular project. That overall working waterfront, I don't know the total acreage, but it's a small acreage footprint, but it means so much to the working waterfront and the families of commercial fishermen and the access that they provide. So it's protecting lobster co-ops, it's protecting access points for clamming, things of that nature. The issue at hand, and Ben was touching on this, is really the bigger areas, Portland, Booth Bay Harbor, where threat to conversion is incredibly, incredibly high, but preserving that access from a working waterfront standpoint would be incredibly expensive. One of the things that the Governor Mills continues to work on and remains a priority for her is the Land for Maine Future Bond. I'm sure that now that the legislature is back today that they'll be taking up the LMF bond soon. But we need to make sure that we, as we discuss the LMF bond and discuss conservation and recreational programs, we also have to continue to talk about how much of that money, how much of that bond will go towards the working waterfront, and can we use that money to potentially leverage some additional work, Congresswoman Pingree's bill, for instance, utilizing state dollars to leverage federal dollars to expand our ability and to protect those areas that are expensive, that have that high threat to conversion.
Well, Ben, thanks so much for calling in. That was Ben Martins, Executive Director of the Maine Coast Fishermen's Association. I have a note, Pat, from our producer, Cindy Hahn, that Sarah Rademacher, is growing elvers into eels. So thank you, Cindy, for that note. And that sounds familiar to me as well now that you say that. Before we go to a break, though, I want to ask you very briefly about the proposed, we talked a little bit about land-based aquaculture. Right now, my understanding is, one, the whole Oceans and Bucksport already has its final permit and is ready to go.
Yeah, they're ready to break ground, and that one is moving forward.
And there'll be public hearings about the Belfast plan in next month.
Belfast is being looked at in a little bit more of an unconventional way, because it'll go through through DEPs, through their advisory group that advises them on larger projects, through the Board of Environmental Protection. So that one is still an ongoing conversation.
And the proposal for the project in Jonesport, which is not a salmon farm but yellowtail, what is the status of that?
The yellowtail continues to look at Jonesport. They're looking at, they have not filed any permits yet, but that's certainly one that poses some promise again for the state of Maine.
All right. Well, we are going to take a quick break, talking with Marine Resources Commissioner Pat Kelleher. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, and if you send an email, please make it brief, talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling, with help from Breakwater Curiosity for Life, offering exceptional day school and after-school options for toddlers through 8th grade, breakwaterlearning.org, and specialized housing, a homeownership setting for adults with developmental disabilities in South Portland and Greater Boston. specializedhousing.org.
Iran's foreign minister insists his country does not want nuclear weapons.
If we wanted to build a nuclear bomb, we would have done it a long time ago.
I'm Ari Shapiro. As Iran breaks limits set in the 2015 nuclear deal, we look at what's known about the country's nuclear capabilities this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's coming up this afternoon between 4 and 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio. Throughout 2020, Maine Public is joining others around the state in celebrating the state of Maine's first 200 years. We're sharing historical information, interesting facts, and personal recollections. We're looking back at how this great state of Maine developed and also peering ahead for the next 200 years. Whether you listen or watch on Maine Public Radio services or television, you can always find it again or for the first time at mainepublic.org. Look for the Maine State Bicentennial Hub link under the radio, television, or education dropdowns, where you will also find links to our bicentennial partners, including the Maine State Archives, the Maine State Historical Society, and the Maine State Bicentennial Commission.
Welcome back. This is Jennifer Rooks and Maine Calling. Today on the program, Maine's Marine Resources, what the concerns and priorities are. My guest today, Pat Kelleher, Commissioner of the Department of Marine Resources. We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Going to go to an email from Carl, Pat. As a kid, 40 to 50 years ago, you could not walk on the rocks without stepping on mussels. The rocks had a blue tint from their color. Now I see no mussels. Why? Global warming, acidification, green crabs?
Two out of the three, definitely. As we've seen temperature increases in the Gulf of Maine over the last several decades, this isn't something that happened in the last couple years. This is a decadal issue from a temperature standpoint. Warmer temperatures created an influx of or an increase in the population of green crabs. Green crabs, we believe, started their level of predation within the mussel beds and on the mussel beds. We certainly had a lot of harvest of wild mussels too, but I don't believe that was the final contributing factor to kind of knock these populations of blue mussels back. We are doing some assessment work down around MDI. We've been doing some drone work with a contractor, doing grid work and looking at the overall population, trying to create an assessment for removal standpoints, because they're removed not only from a wild harvester standpoint, but also the seed mussels are then turned around and used for aquaculture as well. So it is a problem. I'm not sure how we're going to combat that. I think this is, you know, a species that is, as you lose, you see other species potentially filling in. But that's the challenge we're going to have with global warming in the Gulf of Maine.
Carl, good question, and thank you for it. Joining us on the line now, Representative Genevieve McDonald. She is a commercial fisherman from Stonington who represents District 134 and a member of the Joint Standing Committee on Marine Resources. Thanks for calling in, Representative McDonald.
You're very welcome. So I called in today to ask the commissioner about his perspective on the health and the status of the lobster stock.
The other $64 million question. You know, we're going to, as I said earlier, we're going to see a decline in the overall population of lobsters. We have three assessment tools for lobsters to make determination of stock health. One is just the continued monitoring of the landings, and we are seeing unprecedentedly high landings. We believe that has a link to the benefits of global warming, if you want to call global warming beneficial, because we're seeing an expansion of the habitat where the juveniles can settle out. So there's a bigger area for them to settle and thrive in. And so we see an uptick in the population. We also look at doing settlement surveys. So when they do settle to the bottom, we count those that are on the bottom. Because of that expansion of habitat, Rick Wally at the university has been doing some additional work on deep water settlement. And then we've got our ventless trap surveys. And we're seeing right now no really, you know, flashing red lights and red flags other than the landings are tipping downward a little bit. Earlier in the season, it looked like it could be bad. They caught a lot of lobsters in the last few months of the year and made up a lot of ground. We're seeing a lot of juveniles in the traps. So I remain cautiously optimistic, but from a management standpoint, the Atlantic State Marine Fisheries Commission is finalizing a stock status update through their assessment process. And then we may see some additional work from a resiliency amendment to make sure that we have the right reference points in place so we can make management decisions as we start to see declines.
Representative McDonald, before we let you go, I want to ask you, it is opening day of the 2020 legislative session. What do you see as some of the top areas of focus for you this session in terms of marine resources?
In terms of marine resources, a lot of the issues that we're facing aren't actually on the state level, and so we don't have very many marine resource bills in. There is one to study the impacts of pollution on the bays. There is another bill that would allow disabled veterans to receive a free five-tap recreational license for lobster. There's some minor technical changes coming from the department. There is a waitlist bill that was carried over to address the apprentice program in the lobster industry, but we don't have a lot of pressing issues on the state level that we're taking up this session.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us. Representative Genevieve McDonald from Stonington calling in on a busy day. I appreciate it. We're going to go to Jim, who's calling from Bar Harbor. Hi, Jim. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Thanks for listening to me. Hi, Pat. I wanted to ask about the whale deaths up in the Gulf of St. Lawrence, and some observations that I've made indicate that it's the cruise ships have a special lane between PEI and the Gaspé in order to get to Quebec City. All the deaths are happening right around that lane, and there isn't any deaths in the main freighter lanes. So the word cruise ship has not been mentioned in this whole thing, and it's circumstantial evidence shows about six per year, 18 over the past 3 years, have been ship strikes. You know, and I'm counting the undetermined ones who were seen that didn't have rope on them, or it would have been indicated, I would imagine. So the math comes out to 18-plus whales killed by cruise ships. And now when you look at the lobster data from NOAA, a half a whale per year is taken in the past 20 years, according to the map. 10 whales over 20 years.
Jim.
Off of New England.
Jim, thanks for sharing this. Thank you for sharing this information. Do you have a question for the commissioner?
He's been up there and talked with the Oceans and Fisheries about this situation between the cruise ship industry and Canada and the whales. And, you know,
all right, Jim, thank you so much for your call. Is this something, Pat, that has been a part of the conversation?
It is a big part of the conversation. Overall, the issues around right whales and right whale mortalities have certainly been highlighted in Canada, where we've had a lot of deaths and a lot of entanglements over the last 3 years. And Jim is right. Jim has sent me a lot of his data around this and shown the tracks from the case that he's looking at is the cruise ship lines. The shipping industry in general, we're seeing an uptick both in U.S. waters and a big uptick in the Canadian waters when it comes to whale mortalities. The U.S., through NOAA, is having conversations around this particular issue with Canada. I've had several conversations and updates from Canada, but it's a federal government conversation right
now. Is the Canadian federal government taking this as seriously as the U.S. government is?
They don't have a Marine Mammal Protection Act. They don't have an Endangered Species Act right now. They do, but they don't. The right whales don't fall under it from a priority standpoint like it does here in the U.S. So that's one of the frustrating things for us, is that all of the focus is on the U.S. fisheries when all you have to do is look north to find out where the deaths have been occurring. So that's very frustrating from our standpoint. So we're continuing, and with all of our conversations with NOAA, we continue to highlight the issues around ship strike mortalities because it should not fall all on the backs of the U.S. lobster fishery.
All right. Well, Jim, thanks so much for your call in. We're going to go now to Crystal Canny, who is a spokesperson for a group called Protect Maine's Fishing Heritage. Crystal, thanks for calling in. Tell us about your organization. Who is in it?
Sure. It's a variety of people, and thanks for having me on, Jennifer. Good afternoon, Commissioner Kelleher. We started out as an organization out of McCoy Bay, but we rapidly grew into something much bigger. Our membership, if you will, is made up of lobstermen, fishermen, those who recreate on the water, and those who have lived near the ocean for generations, passed down homes, and certainly people who are new to our state, everyone paying a lot of taxes, of course, when they live next to the ocean. So it's a very diverse coalition, but it's people from the traditional fishing heritage, as well as those who recreate and live on the ocean.
So what is your question for the commissioner?
Okay. If I can just jump in with one other thing. We do have a bill pending that has been tabled in Legislative Council, which would make significant changes to the rules and regulations around in-water aquaculture. So without going into the details, my question for the commissioner is the Department of Marine Resources willing to work to ensure there's no conflict between in-water aquaculture, very different than on land, and the existing fishing industries?
So the issues around aquaculture in this particular organization that Crystal's representing have been very interesting to watch unfold because we've seen a lot of information come out of that organization that is false, frankly. The department stands ready to have conversations with the legislature around the issues of aquaculture. We've had very open discussions in the past. The laws that we have in place right now are very clear when it comes to the interactions between other fisheries. I have to take my final decision takes into account other uses, and they do that. So those criteria are set. Those criteria, I believe, continue to give protection to the flora and fauna as well as the other uses.
All right. And some perspective here. Crystal mentioned McCoit Bay, and what we're talking about is a lease of the Mere Point Oyster Company that Crystal, your group, opposed but has been granted. Correct?
Correct. And I've attended, actually. That is correct. It was granted. Our group did oppose it. It will be appealed in court. But I do have to take issue with the commissioner because I've attended probably, I think, between 25 and 30 of the hearings around the state, smaller leases, bigger leases. And I've watched fishermen get up and talk about the fact that they do lobster in these areas, they do fish in these areas, this is an area that's recreated in, and in fact, those leases get approved. So I know there is a general feeling out there that no matter what anyone says, the lease is going to get approved. And I really would take issue with false information. If your office would like to contact me with anything that you think is false, we're certainly willing to have a conversation, Commissioner.
Well, I continue to hear information about the increase of applications coming in and that we grant 99% of them. That information is not correct. We take into account all of these. Back in 2017, I believe we had 21 lease applications, 14 of them were approved. A lot of applications don't even go to the public hearing process because of scoping. They realize there are issues with those, so there are scoping meetings that don't end up turning into an application as well. So, you know, the department is, again, we're willing to have meaningful conversation around the issues around aquaculture. I think aquaculture is a growing industry in the state. It maintains an important role in the state for our working waterfront. We do want to see this continue to grow, but grow in a responsible way. And
we are with you on this, Mr. 100%.
Yeah.
Not an anti-aquaculture group, but we do feel that 1,000-acre leases, or being able to lease up to 1,000 acres, is a real change in the regulations. And what I hear from the fishermen and the lobstermen is they don't like it in general. The lease going from 10 to 20 acres. And we're talking about the 3-mile inshore area, right? We're not talking about the whole ocean. And it does vary.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Crystal. We have other calls we need to get to. I really appreciate you calling in and sharing this part of the perspective. The obvious tension that's going to continue to grow, it seems, between as aquaculture grows along the coast, along folks who have other reasons to want to use that piece the piece of acreage on the water.
Yeah, and she made a statement about owning and then quickly talked about the lease. I mean, these are just that. They're leases. They go through a very rigorous process, regulatory process, to get to that point. These aren't things that happen over a few weeks. These are things that take upwards of a year or more in some cases where there is opposition to get through the process. So these are open, transparent processes, and there are court remedies if people don't like them, and that sounds like what they're going to do and try to resolve this in the courts now.
So, All right.
And that's their prerogative.
Crystal, I appreciate you calling in. That's Crystal Canny from Protect Maine's Fishing Heritage. We're going to go to an email from Karen. I have heard a lot in the news about illegal fishing activities. My understanding is that this cheating has had a negative impact on the entire groundfish fishery, including Maine fishermen. What is the commission doing to prevent this from happening again and to protect honest fishermen who are trying to make a living?
It's hard to really, I mean, that's a very broad statement without a lot of detail as it pertains to ground fishing. The groundfish sector is in rebuilding mode in many cases. Gulf of Maine cod, we continue to hear about the decline in Gulf of Maine cod. There was some further reductions there recently. But in general, whether it's ground fishing or whether it is lobstering or any other thing, what we want to maintain is an even playing field. The Maine Department of Marine Resources has a Bureau of Marine Patrol. We have 52 officers covering 5,000 miles of coastline when you start to include the islands. So it's a very daunting task. What we always ask for is voluntary compliance. I can hear retired Colonel Pheasanton saying that over and over again and having conversations with individuals in the past when they would come in for a license suspension. It's all about our enforcement is community-based enforcement model. My officers live and work in the communities that they interact with these fishermen on a daily basis, and we think we do a pretty good job at it.
What about people who aren't from the community, though? For example, from other states?
Yeah, and so that's the type of information that we need to get. We are able to work that information, investigate that information, and so if we have vessels from other states, all of our officers are federally deputized. They can board other boats from other states. We can investigate those boats and investigate any of those type of complaints. So we've got a lot of authority when it comes to that. An equal playing field is really, really, really key. And if we know of those issues, we work them very hard.
We are going to take another quick break. We're talking with DMR Commissioner Pat Kelleher. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Andrucki and King, featuring Judy Andrucki, providing private mediation services in matters of family law, AndruckiLaw.com. Fresh Eggs Daily, a Maine company committed to helping you to raise the backyard chicken flock of your dreams, FreshEggsDaily.com. And Central Maine Healthcare's Topsom Care Center, bringing specialty care, imaging, lab services, and more to one convenient location at the Topsom Fair Mall.
On This Day in Maine's History is brought to you in partnership with the Maine Historical Society.
On January 8, 1880, war hero, former Maine governor, and former president of Bowdoin College, Joshua Chamberlain formally took control of the Maine State House while a dispute about who was the newly elected governor of Maine was being resolved. The outgoing governor, Alonzo Garcelon, summoned Chamberlain, the commander of the Maine militia at the time, to take charge of the contentious situation until the Maine Supreme Judicial Court's decision on the election results was known.
On This Day in Maine's History is made possible through the generous support of Bernstein Scher and Maine Masons celebrating their bicentennial in Maine. Happy birthday, Maine!
Hello, I'm Jane Wales, host of World Affairs. The social contract has frayed, but there's a role for business, for governments, and for all of us to rebuild it. Next on World Affairs, we'll hear from J. Cohen Gilbert, co-founder of B Corp, and Colin Meyer of Oxford University. They'll be taking part in the second of our three-part series on rebuilding the social contract.
That's coming up today at 2 here on Maine Public Radio.
Right. Welcome. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, I'm talking with Department of Marine Resources Commissioner Pat Kelleher. Our conversation, you can join it at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Facebook post from Robin. Incredibly, rockweed belonging to the Ross brothers, plaintiffs in the four-year case against Harvester's Acadian Sea Plants in Maine Supreme Court, was taken again from the Ross's property by Acadian Sea Plants without Ross's permission in September. The Ross's filed a complaint. What has DMR done with the Ross's complaint on this violation? What does DMR plan to do with other such complaints? So this is a very specific question, but Pat, I want to go back a little bit and let's talk about where it's coming from. Rockweed is a type of seaweed, and there was just a big decision about who controls the intertidal land where it can be harvested. It decided that the property owners, the land property owners, can control that. You were telling me that DMR opposed that.
We did. We had a brief written from an attorney and in opposition to that, because we believe that rockweed, the harvest of rockweed is a fishery, and that as such, the department has the ability to manage it that way. The law court actually footnoted all of the work we did in their decision and basically said that this was not part of the earlier arguments, and as such, it was not our arguments were not weighed within their decision. What we believe is that because rockweed does not derive its nutrients from the soil, it derives from the water and from the sun, it just holds on to the rocks and with a holdfast. That because of that, it remained a fishery. And law court disagreed. They've made a decision. That's now the law of the land. So whether we've disagreed or not, we follow the laws. Now, I can't speak to that particular complaint that Robin Hadlock-Seely has brought up, but I do know that overall we had many complaints this year, but we had many more people calling us and saying that they were calling other people to complain and not the Maine Marine Patrol. If somebody is harvesting and somebody believes that they're harvesting on their property, then they need to call the Maine Marine Patrol, and they will investigate. We need to know who owns that land, though, in order to make a case. And in all cases, as you look at deeds, it's not clear. Some stop at the high water mark. Some may say that the line travels at an easterly direction to the low water mark. But some may say rights are retained, and it's not clear if those rights are ownership to what. And so we're not, by any stretch of the imagination, deed lawyers. The officers, the Maine Marine Patrol officers, need to see and know that they have an ownership case, because it's not trespass, it's theft. So writing a ticket for theft is not an insurmountable thing when from an evidence standpoint when you go in front of the courts. So we need good proof that who owns the land, whether a theft took place, and then if we can show that, we're going to move forward with a case. So,
We'll go to Ernie, who's calling from Chibig Island. Hi, Ernie. Go ahead.
Hi, Pat. First, I want to say Pat Kelleher is one hell of a good commissioner, and we've seen a lot of him.
Thanks, Ernie.
I've been a fisherman for 66 years, and I think he's a good guy, and I think he's a fair guy. I've talked with him several times. Get a really good impression of his leadership abilities. And I wanted to talk about access to fishing grounds, access to our communities. I live on an island, town of Chibig Island, I was on the planning. I'm an ex-member of the planning board. I was on it for several years, and we have a access situation on the island where our pier is, in my opinion, inadequate, and we need to develop new transportation facilities here on the island. And we recently had a hearing on an aquaculture lease that was directly off from a proposed site for our new possible new pier. And I fish around probably about 8 different aquaculture leases as it is now, and I see a very fast proliferation of the number of leases in my particular area where I fish. And I'm very concerned that we have no limit on the number of aquaculture leases that can be issued. I'm very concerned that aquaculture leases can be sold without hearing. I have a number of concerns about aquaculture laws, and I believe that the legislature of the state of Maine, when bills are presented to take into account, I believe that the Marine Resources Committee should do a much better, more thorough job of looking into some of the problems that exist between the fisheries, not just the lobster fisheries either, but the fisheries as a whole, and the aquaculture laws.
Thank you, Ernie. Pat, this is what we were talking about before.
Yeah, and so, Ernie, I appreciate the kind words, and I always do enjoy talking to Ernie. He's got a very good perspective and a long perspective with his time on the water. I can say I believe what he's talking about is an open and active lease application, so I can't comment directly on that. But from a standpoint of that lease impacting other issues associated with access and commercial fisheries, those will be taken into account. If there is an issue associated with potential conflict with a new pier on Chibigue, for instance, which I'm not aware of, those need to be highlighted, and we can have conversations around those. I do want to just throw out a little bit of information, though. People continue to talk about this kind of big growth in aquaculture, and there is growth in aquaculture. There's no denying that. There's currently less than 1,500 total acres along our coast in state waters where there are leases. So just to put that in perspective, there's 3.5 million acres along of water inside that 3-mile line. So the percentage-wise, it's not a huge percentage. It doesn't have to be, though. What Ernie's talking about is something that's real within a community that needs to be talked about. And so we're continuing, as I said earlier, with an earlier call, we're happy to have conversations around what those challenges are. LPAs are a big growth area and something that I believe needs to be under control, and I want to try to create some...
What's an LPA?
The Limited Purpose Aquaculture License. That's a very small area, 400 square feet, and they were originally meant to basically prospect. Is this a good area or is it not a good area? But what people have done is they've taken, a primary person and said, okay, I'm going to go get my 400-acre LPAs, and then I'm going to have some for my wife and my 2 kids. And they've kind of gotten around the leasing component by doing that. And yes, they have to renew them annually, and there are a license, and there are all kinds of criteria associated with them. But we need to make sure that that does not become a problem as well. That said, there's only 6 acres total in the state when you add them all up. So we have to put it into perspective, right? There are some localized areas that are of concern, but overall, up and down the coast, I think we've done a really damn good job.
Ernie, thanks for your call. We have an email from Paul. Do lobster people have to pay for the area they harvest? Farmers have to buy or lease land. Do fishermen pay for water?
They do not. They pay for a commercial fishing license, in this case, in this example, a lobster license, that grants them the privilege, not the right, the privilege to be able to harvest a public resource.
All right. We'll go to Dorothy, who's calling from Brunswick. Hi, Dorothy. Go ahead.
Yes, hello. I'd like to talk about those little eels again.
Sure.
And the woman who's fattening them up so that we can make more money from the sale of them here, is she also studying about how they propagate? Because something that I read not long ago, I thought, was saying that we really don't know how they propagate, and they seem to take an awful long time to get from there to here for us to be able to catch them and make a lot of money from them. So can you tell me if we know anybody who really knows how they propagate?
Dorothy, it's a great question at the end of a program, and elvers, glass eels, are endlessly fascinating, aren't they, Pat?
They are, and I've worked on them for the better part of my career. Early on, I was paid to actually try to close the fishery down 25 years ago because it was uncontrolled and unregulated. And as you said earlier, we've got it under control. And Dorothy, I love the fact that you've put it really bluntly, that because what Sarah's job is to fatten them up for market, and that's what she does. The propagation side is one that has been looked at, and hundreds of millions of dollars have been spent to try to figure out how to get them to breed in captivity. There's been some minimal success, but not at the commercial level. And I know Sarah's worked on this. I know I know within other countries, whether it be in Asia or in Europe, it's been worked on. But they haven't cracked the code yet. And if they do, somebody's probably going to be really rich.
Dorothy, thanks so much for your call. Pat, we just have a couple minutes left, and I want to kind of take that time to talk about the backdrop in front of which we're having all of these conversations, which is climate change and how it's affecting the Gulf of Maine. You've had this job, we've mentioned, since 2011. Could you have predicted how much would change in that time? And what do you see going forward?
It's warming waters in the Gulf of Maine. I remember having a conversation with the former governor, saying, "You know, we have a warming problem here." And I showed him the temperature data, and the temperature data over a 100-year period fluctuated, but it has gone up just a few degrees. Just a few degrees is really meaningful, and when it comes to these species that are native to the Gulf of Maine, Governor Mills thankfully has prioritized global warming and climate change. We have a climate council that's working. I've got a lot of staff working on the coastal committee for the climate change. We could not have anticipated what we're seeing now. There's no way we would have anticipated that we were going to land over 130 million pounds of lobsters. When I was a kid going with my cousins on Cliff Island, and this was a long time ago now, they were catching 20 million pounds a year using wooden traps. So things have changed from a lobster perspective. One of my first years on the job, we were told to look at the statutes on the books within Title 12 and get rid of things that weren't needed. We got rid of green crab laws, and that year we had an explosion in the green crab population. The fact that we have black sea bass in catchable numbers in areas of the state. Sometimes one year we may not see them, but the next year we may people are catching them with rod and reel, and fishermen are seeing them in their traps. We never would have expected that. And the one thing that is crystal clear to me is we need to do a better job monitoring our environment here. And that's something that I think and hope will become a focus of the Climate Council.
All right. Well, final words from Commissioner Pat Kelleher, Maine's Commissioner of the Department of Marine Resources. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. This is Maine Public Radio.